The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Do you really think all this is an accident? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, John?
The island.
Look, you want to push the button? You do it yourself.
If it's not real, then what are you doing here, Jack? Why did you come back? Why do you find it so hard to believe?
Why do you find it so easy?
It's never been easy!
It's a leap of faith, Jack.
Two players. Two sides. One is light. One is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back!
We're going to need to watch that again.
Hello and welcome to the Storm and Lost Rewatch Podcast. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and I would take Pink Floyd's The Wall as my album to take down into the hatch with me.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and if I were to take an album down into the hatch with me, it would be the Beatles' White Album because it's cheating. It's a double album.
And I'm Neil Miller, and if I were to be heading down into a hatch, I would probably take something calming, something like Miles Davis, kind of blue. I imagine being in a hatch would cause me a lot of anxiety. So I would need something soothing. I would probably also need to take a giant bag of weed into this hatch, if I'm being really honest.
Would you inject it via some sort of like pressure thing into your arm?
I mean, if that's the easiest way to make it happen, sure.
No, you hotbox the underground geodesic dome.
Oh, yeah. Hotbox the dome.
Hot hatch.
We're in the hatch.
You figure out how magnets work.
Hatch.
We finally blew open the hatch, and we finally get to go down it in this episode, season 2, episode 1, Man of Science, Man of Faith, here on this Lost Rewatch podcast. It's a podcast where we are rewatching the ABC series Lost. We split the podcast into two pieces, what we like to call The Calm, which is for all of you that are going through Lost for the very first time. We will only be talking about the first season of Lost and the first episode of the second season of Lost, Man of Science, Man of Faith, in the first part of this podcast. And the second part of this podcast, which we like to call The Storm, because we used to be a podcast called Storm of Spoilers. That's where we have the spoilers, aka the things we notice on this rewatch, having seen all six seasons of Lost. Patreon.com/Storm of Spoilers, something we've set up in our long and storied history is a podcast watching television, is where you could go to not only support us and us making this now Lost content, previously Game of Thrones content, and in a couple weeks Star Wars content, but you could get other special subscriber content like extra episodes and weird posts from me about music I made in with my high school friends that shouldn't scare you off. Actually, come back. We also watch movies together and vote on like which special things we're gonna watch Hocus Pocus together this month, the month of October. It's going to be fantastic. You should definitely go there and check it out. And also, if you're listening to this in a timely fashion, first of all, thank you for joining us after last week's 3-hour-long finale episode so soon. We're back with season 2 of Lost. We're going to keep going for the first 6 episodes of Lost, doing a little kicking off the miniseries. You'll see why as we get in the second series of Lost. Like, the first 3 episodes are basically the premiere, as far as I'm concerned, story-wise. But after Season 2, Episode 6, we're going to take a break and start talking about Star Wars. That is going to include a live show, November 21st, at the Canyon Theater at the Boulder Public Library. Joanna, where can people go if they want to get tickets or reserve spots to this free show?
Oh my gosh, I believe. Yes, I am right. If you go to soslive show.com, that's soslive show.com, it'll take you straight to the Boulder Public Library page where our event is featured, and you can register, which is a free event, but you just want to register to make sure you have a seat for the event coming up next month. So do it.
Excellent. That is my spiel. Is there any other way that people can get in contact with us that is important?
Oh my God, yeah. All you have to do is like get in your spinny chair, roll on up to your Apple II computer, type in an email to us. Hosts@stormpodcast.com is how you can email us. We've got a website, stormpodcast.com. It's got a bunch of like our info and updated events, et cetera, on there. You can tweet at us at Storm Podcast, which is always really fun. If you follow us there, we've got like polls going and little clips of audio teasing the interviews, et cetera, so you can do all of that. We have an email this week I want to read really quickly. So hosts@stormpodcast.com, you can email us and have your email read out loud on our podcast. What an honor. Amy wrote in and she says, I wasn't as quick as Neil to think who when it came to who was down the hatch. I think we asked our listeners, like, what did you think was down the hatch? She's like, I didn't think it was a who. Hard to be sure of my memory, but I don't believe I even assumed that there was a chamber on the island down there. For all I knew, the hatch opening, so securely fastened, might be a portal to another dimension or something. So that's true. I mean, like, I think now with hindsight, we're like, oh yeah, who did you think was living down there? And other people are like, what do you mean? Who did I think was living down there?
Hold on, though. Yeah. So Amy's argument, if I understand it correctly, is that it's easier to believe that it's a portal to a different dimension than that someone's just down there.
I don't know about easier to believe. She's just sort of like, that was my first thought.
Fair enough. You know, like, it's funny. Yeah. It's like, I don't know, portal to another dimension. That one. No, I don't think I ever thought of that one. I'll be honest.
We also got an email from Steven, a.k.a. DJ Empirical, who did our opening song, our theme song, which cats like to dance to. So Steven wrote, y'all, I just want to reach out to you and say thanks. Lost is a show I never watched and never had interest in watching, so I was a little disappointed when that was your destination after Game of Thrones. That being said, I was game for trying it out, at least for a little while, especially as this would be a great chance to test Dave's It's All About the Execution theory. So I've been trekking along, watching and listening to the Storm section without much real interest, and sometimes with some annoyance looking at you, the moth. It wasn't until about episode 12 where I realized, holy shit, there's been a gestalt shift in my view of the show, and I am suddenly, in all caps, into it. And the three-part finale, which I watched all at once, really kicked my interest up higher with the hatch and the smoke monster, one of the few references about the show I could have named a few months ago. And Bo fucking Crowder and crew taking Walt. Oh, yeah, that was Bo Crowder. Good call. MC Gainey. Now with your massive finale episode dropping today, so this he sent this email last week, I had another revelation. When I got to the Storm and y'all started in on a couple very specific things about blank and Blake, I suddenly realized I kind of didn't want to hear it. So thanks for getting me into the show enough that you've steered me into being a commie, a thing I legit did not think could happen. Dave, you'll need a different test subject for your theory, I think. Thanks for the wonderful Lost podcast, y'all. And don't even get me started on the gushing about the wonderful Game of Thrones incarnation of the show or the amazing community of folks in the Slack. Biggest of hearts, Steven. So thank you, Steven. Steven, who we met at Con of Thrones. Steven, who's been a Slack Patreon subscriber since the start. So
who also crushed it at karaoke.
Oh, yeah.
Just... if anybody's keeping score at home, who crushed it at Con of Thrones karaoke?
Neil?
I did.
Yeah.
Steven did.
Maddie did.
Maddie did.
Yeah.
So start a list. Someone can get a spreadsheet going.
We also like to hear from you guys via iTunes reviews. That's a great way for us to sort of like increase awareness of our podcast. So let me read a quick one from Coach C. Tiller. 5 stars, a few of my favorite things. I didn't listen to this pod for Game of Thrones for fear of spoilers, but I had listened to Joanna on A Cast of Kings and elsewhere, and when she said they were doing a Lost rewatch, I jumped. My wife, a first-time watcher, and I have been watching the show, and it's been great. Loved Lost when it was on, but I hadn't watched since the initial run. I feel like I'm back with old friends. The show was always about the characters for me, not the mysteries. Been reminded of so much that I loved, and this podcast has made the rewatch even better. Love the host, their banter, and the fact that they don't take themselves too seriously. That's right. Even though we've zoomed by where the pod currently is, and I've almost finished season two, I really enjoyed the analysis, and the interviews have been great. I especially enjoyed all the interviews with folks from the show, especially Jorge Garcia and Damon Lindelof. Can't wait for more, and I'm also really looking forward to the Star Wars interlude. Keep up the great work. Have I got good news for you, Coach C. Tiller. If you're a fan of interviews with people who've worked on the show, then I will tell you to stick around. Our guest this week loves keeping fit on stationary bikes, loves putting maraschino cherries in smoothies, loves injecting mystery medicine into his body. We have Henry Ian Cusick, a.k.a. Desmond. Did we get his last name in this episode?
We did not. Right?
Oh, Desmond Bleep.
Desmond from the Hatch.
Desmond from Desmond Hatchman. Desmond Stadium Runman.
Of the Island Hatchmans.
Desmond, yeah, brother.
Of the Island Hatchmans. Anyway, Desmond Hatchman, Henry Ian Cusick himself, will be on the podcast. He doesn't sound exactly like Desmond. I just want to warn you that. And we get into that right at the start of the interview. I'm like, why don't you sound like Desmond? I didn't say it like that, but we talk about it. So
I'm so sad right now because you don't sound like Desmond.
No, not at all. I just, like, you know, he didn't even live his whole life in Scotland. He grew up in Trinidad. He's an interesting fellow. We chatted. It's great. Stay tuned. That's all my stuff. I'm done.
Fantastic. Let's get down to it then. Man of science, man of faith. Neil, what happened on the island?
Well, guys, in this, the premiere episode of season two, this was directed by Jack Bender, who you'll remember directed all three parts of Exodus and a bunch of other things that we like. It was written by Damon Lindelof, who was a guest on this podcast just last week. Very big news. It aired on September 21st, 2005, and it takes place on day 44 on the island. In flashbacks, we watch as Jack is forced to choose between two patients in the emergency room. He has to let a man named Adam Rutherford, who I guess we can say is related to a character we've already met named Rutherford. Anyway, Adam is left to die so that he can save a woman named Sarah, who I believe we've met already. Jack uses the power of his terrible flashback hair to repair Sarah's broken back despite all the doubters, i.e. his damn father and basically all of science were working against him there. A miracle happens. It's great. While he's stressing about Sarah's surgery, he hurts his ankle running the stairs of a stadium called the Tour de Stade. It's here that he meets Desmond, a man who promises they'll meet again in another life, brother. On the islands, we open on an eye. Whose eye? Wait, what's happening here? Why does it look like a Cold War bunker? Who is this handsome man? Oh shit, he's inside the hatch. Boom, lost. Jack immediately abandons the plan once he notices that the hatch is too tall and there's no ladder that goes all the way down. He's like, I'm going back. John and Kate remain fascinated with the hatch. Elsewhere, Shannon goes looking for Vincent, who she has already lost. Instead of finding Vincent, well, sort of finding Vincent, she hears some whispers. She sees soggy, overgrown Walt. And then she sort of loses it, which we'll probably have to talk about. Back at the hatch, Locke and Jack continue to have a philosophical disagreement about what they should do. It's pretty much takes all episode. Locke drops Kate down the hole, loses her, goes in to see what happened. Jack shows up, also goes down the hole by himself, explores a bit, and then meets, bum bum bum, Desmond, who is in the damn hole, brother. He ends up in a standoff between Jack, Desmond. Desmond's holding a gun to Locke's head. It's a real pickle, brother. Not so fun fact, Adam Rutherford, who is killed as a result of the collision with Sarah, we talked about him, is pronounced dead at 8:15 a.m., and as Hurley would remind you, the numbers 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, 42. Here is one related to the numbers that is fun from this episode, according to Lostpedia. There are 42 holes in the showerhead that Desmond uses in the opening scene.
What?
Yeah, so yes. It's that detailed. This week's opening question, have you ever run a Tour de Stade? I'm asking because I have run a Tour de Stade, and it almost killed me, and that's why I quit track in the ninth grade. But have you guys ever tried to run the stairs of a stadium?
I don't think I could even walk a Tour de Stade. Like, fuck no. Dave?
I'm going to say...
This is where we find out that Dave was once a Olympic-class distance runner or some shit.
Well, though, I'm going to say no, but we did run the equivalent in, like, a high school bleacher stadium in high school. Like,
yeah, that was mine, but it was, like, two bleachers on each side of the football field and had, like, eight rows each. You had to do both sides. It was terrible.
Yeah, yeah. In that case, yes. I'm going to file under yes. If high school stadiums count, then absolutely. I have not done whatever the fuck Jack's doing there,
which
seems insane.
Eating shit?
Yeah, I will also say that I have, and we know that I have a long history on this podcast of not falling down and being very strong in this area. But when I was in, I believe it was like the ninth grade, I was doing shot put and discus in track because, I don't know, I guess it was like required or somebody made me. I don't remember why. But I also ate shit like Jack ate shit on concrete steps like that once. And It was bad. I didn't like break anything, but it hurt a lot. So I remember watching this, and when Jack falls, I'm like, oh, I've been there, bud.
When Jack falls up the stairs, oh!
What?
He doesn't fall back down the
Desmond,
stairs.
Desmond trots down the stairs. Jack falls up the stairs, Desmond trots down the stairs. Right?
And then yes, Kate falls down the hole.
Kate falls down the hole.
Bye, Kate.
So this is the most watched episode of Lost ever, mm-hmm. coming out of season one. And I think the beginning of one of my favorite periods of Lost, which is the season two, they're on top of the world and they come up with like this way of not only drawing out like weird character reveals, but stacking an obscene amount of mystery on. Which begins with the opening sequence with Desmond's routine in the hatch, which has so many questions about, like, exactly what time period he's been down there since, because, like, Desmond's not that old. They didn't, like, put a baby down there. And then, obviously, there's an Apple IIe.
Did they not put a baby?
I mean, maybe they did put a baby down there. Would the baby be able... Oh, maybe that's what his little injections are, right? Is he's super speeding up. We have the speeding up his growth. We have the quarantine on the hatch. We have just mystery after mystery that pile on. And I don't mean to give away anything to anybody who wants to stay in the calm, but this entire season sort of paced that way. If the first season was behind the scenes, a little bit of a hot potato or keeping a balloon in the air after an extremely successful pilot, and then the writers and sort of finding the story around the performers and around the production, season two tries to keep a laser-like focus and is sometimes very successful and other times admirable in its failure in a way that I don't think really happened for me again until I saw Breaking Bad season two, where if you take all the first words of the titles that have black and white flashback sequences, it spells out a spoiler for the finale. But that's like the weird level of Lost theorizing that was happening at the time of season two. And because the
you
show
mean
was
Brickfang, do you mean Brickfang?
Do I mean Brickfang?
Yeah.
No.
You talked about Better Call Saul, right?
No. Did he do it also in Better Call Saul?
Yeah.
No, I'm talking about was it Two Down over ABQ?
In Better Call Saul, the first letters of the season three episodes, I think it was three, maybe two, spelled out a tease of something to come. Viewers figured it out early on, but I was hosting a podcast at the time with Dave Chen and his brother. Chen brother original. Decided to come up, like, he's like, we don't know that that's what the acronym is. Maybe it's Brickfang. which it was not Brick Fang, but that is forever. It was the thing that people thought it was, but I won't say in case you are saving Better Call Saul. But Brick Fang, it was not. So anyway, yes. Sorry.
I'm also sorry I said the spoiler, but also kind of not, because like I said with both Lost Season 2 and Breaking Bad Season 2, sometimes the execution is just admirable in that they tried it. And it, like, it makes something. I don't think, you know, Two Town Over ABQ makes any sense if you've never seen Breaking Bad.
No,
but luckily, a lot of stuff here that's introduced in this first episode is immediately addressed in the next two episodes, but in a way that I think is Lost being aware of what type of show it is and being very confident of that. And I think season two is a very confident presentation of what the first half of Lost is. Season three sort of, it's on shaky ground for production reasons, and everybody was sort of wondering where they were going with it. And then the latter seasons we'll get to when we get to. I love me some season two. I love that we're here. I'm still, it's being that I've catching up with this rewatch and haven't sprung ahead, I'm thought I'd be able to say more things about season two before I started Man of Science, Man of Faith, because of how well season two is interwoven. So that's how my comments came about. Neil, we're in the hatch. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Hatch.
But really early on, as you pointed out, we have the split between the man of science and the man of faith, Jack and Locke, on as to whether or not they should go down the hatch. Is it different for you rewatching it now, so close to Exodus, on whose side you're on? Because for me, I think if I'd been waiting a whole summer between seasons, or some, like, I think it was 119 days between Exodus and Man of Science, Man of Faith, I would have been much more on Locke's side than having just watched Exodus recently, where I'm like, there's still the threat of others as far as they know, like an army of others.
Yeah, I don't think whose side I'm on has changed with this, with rewatching an Exodus. I will say that I appreciate how the energy that Exodus brought, in especially in parts two and three, really sort of carries over here. Like, you really feel the urgency and of the whole situation. I like that they keep the conversation going basically between Jack and Locke, and I like that they're, you know, sort of moving through the episode as they're having it. I don't know. I think what I really like about it is that I'm just enjoying watching them spar, because to me, it feels more like I should just live in this moment with these two actors doing these very cool things. And, so I'm not even really thinking about who I believe is right or wrong. It's just that the show seems more interested in defining, you know, defining them as man of science, man of faith, and sort of really digging in and exploring that. And I think that's one of the things I really like about season two, is season two gets a little more philosophical. Season two gets more, as we've said, very confident. And I think as Joanna talked with Damon Lindelof about last week, you know, that once they figured out what was in the hatch, that seemed like a fairly big turning point for them. And then once they kind of got to Exodus and got through that first season, they started to feel more confident as a mystery show. So it's cool. The mysteries, like, kind of explode in this episode, and there's details. It's fun because you can tell that the inside of the hatch was so important because of how much detail is in there, like how many questions are now created by the time we spent in the hatch, which is not that long in this episode. And I love that. And I love that they just sort of come out swinging in season two. So no, I don't actually remember who I think is right here just yet. I think that, it's really interesting that Jack is like interested in the hatch and then gives up very quickly. And then he's very against the hatch for a long time. And then right at the end, he's like, well, I just changed my mind. I'm going back. You know, Jack is not honest at all about what's going on here in his mind and his heart.
I think they brush it over with the flashback, but I also think it says on Lostpedia there is a conversation between Jack and Charlie that was cut, where Charlie suggests that Kate, like, talk to Jack because she secretly wanted him to tell her to stay. You know, like, it isn't safe with Locke, which maybe Joanna, Kate, very brave this episode. That being said, Locke, who you keep insisting is not an antagonist, sends her down that hole first.
Because she's lighter.
Oh, so practicality, yeah. That makes sense.
I do. I will say that, does it
listen,
does
if
it
all
not
three
feel...
of us were standing around the hatch, Dave, we would send you down. You're the
that's true.
You're our hatch bud. Sorry.
It is kind of weird that, like, Kate basically turns into Boone for one episode. Like,
yeah,
she, all of a sudden, she's just chilling. Because, she's just on Locke's side after she said that conversation with Jack.
Yeah, honestly, I kind of think that it's a little bit of a convenience here. Because the reason Jack really goes down there is because of Kate, right? And he's,
right,
like, hyper-concerned about where Kate is. And so, like, I almost think, not like he's an antagonist, but I almost think that Jack is, that Locke is like, if I get Kate down there, Jack will probably follow.
Then I'll get Jack down there.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting. So you think Locke, yeah, wants more people to share with his whole hatch revelation?
Well, I mean, yeah. Maybe he just needs Kate's strong arms to get down that hatch. I don't know. Who knows? But I think it's like a plot convenience. They need Kate down that hatch because they need Jack down that hatch. So.
Right. And that's the only thing that makes Jack's final, when he's walking away, who's he talking to at the end there? Is it Hurley? And he's like, why are you going back? And Jack's like, I just changed my mind. And it's like, it's 100% about Kate at that point.
Yeah. Cause that's the only part that, well, luckily we have Jack flashbacks, flashbacks to, not only show us horrible wigs, but once again, show us Jack having a really tough time being a doctor, and to his future wife, he's just like hopeless and weepy and smelly and making promises and just more bad doctoring.
And he does the Dr. Shepherd. I think I really love everyone's performance in the scene where he tells her, "I'm going to fix you." Because first of all, she's amazing in that sequence, and then, like, just the eye looks that everybody gives him after he says, I'm going to fix you, and she passes out is real just top notch. Like, there's so much side eye and his face just like, oh shit, I just said the worst possible thing I could say to somebody before they go out for surgery.
Yeah. And Christian's like,
Christian's like grabbing a, you know, bottle of scotch and heading for the door.
But even I wouldn't.
Yeah. Not even on my drunkest day, kid.
Yeah, it's interesting because this is maybe my favorite. Is this my favorite Julie Bowen performance? I love her in this episode.
Oh, she's amazing in this episode.
I think she's incredibly good in this episode.
When she messes with him, well, I guess when they're talking at the end about her being able to wiggle her toes.
Yeah.
You kind of believe she's half messing with him and half legitimately confused at what's going on.
We also have to, maybe I should create a new award that's the, like, Brian Porter Memorial Asshole Award. It goes
the
to
fiance,
played by Anson Mount, who you Star Trekkies might know.
And, oh shit. He was in Admiral that train Pike. Show. Hell on Wheels.
He wasn't Hell on Wheels. He's also in the seminal Britney Spears film Crossroads.
Didn't he play Black Bolt in the?
Oh yeah,
in that
That's
show
right.
with he Ramsey did. Bolton.
Disney Plus's Inhumans.
Is that one of the Disney Plus shows?
You better believe they still have the rights to Inhumans. Who wanted to stream Inhumans?
Yeah, can't wait for season two. Where's the Save Inhumans hashtag?
Yeah, the Brian Porter Memorial Asshole Award goes to Sarah's fiance.
Well, yes, in the story world of Lost, absolutely. In the world of this is a television show and we already know Jack gets married to this woman, like, if if the on-island story didn't end the way it did, where I'm starting to wonder if this island is, like, personally punishing Jack because we have, you know, Ghost Dad, and now we have random dude from his past popping up in this hatch they've been trying to open. Like, there's the flashback. I don't see the narrative benefit in us knowing that they get married and then eventually divorced at the beginning of this flashback. Like, it treats it sort of like more about Faith, which, thank God, we have the island plot to go off of. But otherwise, like, the flashbacks are good despite the what they've been saddled with. This premiere made me feel so much like I wanted just to see more on the island.
That's what every one of our listeners who have, like, or not every single one, but a lot of our listeners who have watched the show before but are trying to watch it week by week with us, all of them have said to me, not all of them, a lot of them said to me, this is the hardest time I had stopping after this episode. So,
yeah.
Well, yeah, because like Dave said at the beginning, and astutely pointing out, this is it's a very sort of an unfinished story. It's part one of essentially three that sort of make up the beginning of this season. So, yeah, like, we don't get any of what's going on with the dudes on the raft, for instance.
Yep, that's because Sawyer's dead.
It's like the Game of Thrones. There was one season where Game of Thrones did this, where they did an episode. They used to do the episode where they check in with everybody at the beginning of season one. And then there was one year where they didn't quite get to everybody. And then, you know, episode two comes right back to those characters. So it's interesting because it's both more confident and more patient in the second season, you know?
Yeah. So we don't know where the rafties are.
Mm-hmm.
I think we could still also be in Shannon's head when she is, you know, claiming to have really seen Walt, and Son's asking if the raft is back, and we're thinking Walt being dripping wet can't be good because we know what's been going on. But all
what?
Of
it- is that funny?
Exactly. I mean, don't wear yourself out.
Overgrown, you're gonna be doing that soggy Walt
next week.
That's what he is.
What? Walt!
But yeah, Shannon lost the dog and now has heard the whispers as well as Walt, who says something that sounds like it's backwards talking. And that's all I have to say about that. Joanna, how are we doing with Shannon, who seems very angry at herself for losing Vincent, but she did lose Vincent the night that the raft set sail.
Let's just remind ourselves that Shannon's brother died, like, just a couple days ago. It's easy to forget. It's even been a few weeks on the show, but just, like, a couple days ago, Boone fell down the stairs.
But even so, Shannon seems a little upset with herself at how quickly she lost Vincent.
I lost the damn dog, doesn't she say?
Yeah. She's like, this is the one time anyone's ever asked me to do anything.
Yeah.
Which isn't even true, Shannon. Come on.
Yeah. People have been asking you to do things this whole time.
You did the French song. Remember the song? I remember that.
Oh, yeah. You looked at the papers for, like, a couple of days.
You guys, ease off, Shannon.
Yeah. No, I'm saying she needs to ease off herself.
Yeah.
She has been contributing, but she should also keep better track of that dog. I'm split as I always am between proper canine care and wanting to be sympathetic to it.
Yeah, but think about it from Vincent's perspective, though. This is a dog who has had a rough life. He's traveled around a lot. He used to belong to fucking Brian. And now he's in a jungle of mystery. Like, that dog wants to run around and explore. I'm sorry.
I have the most having known that Vincent knows what's going on. Yeah. All the survivors.
Having
I
known
can't wait
several
till someone
dogs.
Ties him up to a tree so he can be, I'm tied to a tree.
Mystery. I'm just saying, having known many dogs in my life, they're very good at exploring and also knowing where the food is. So I assume Vincent will make his way back to the food. Shannon can just chill. Saeed's probably right. She needs to just, like, sleep.
just needs to calm down a little bit. Not worry about the masses of maybe other people, the others.
Yeah, or maybe just get, like, hydrate.
This is what Jack said to Claire when Claire's like, someone's trying to kidnap me. Jack's like, shh, take a nap. You're fine. Remember that? Stop telling women on this island to sleep and start listening to them.
Well, I guess you could do what Kate does and just drug Shannon.
I mean, it's not a bad plan.
Just give her a little goop. Just a little bit of goop.
Yeah, just goop her a little bit. She'll be fine.
Just a glop of the gloop. That's all you need. Just a glop of the goop. All right. So we have a few like awards to get through. I know we're not done with the comm. I just want to see them through.
Yes.
And I'm going to start here with the Boone Carlyle Memorial Don't Fall Down Award. And we've decided that it's a tie, possibly, between Jack eating shit in the stadium and Kate falling down the hatch. Okay. Can I just say really quickly before we get to this? My number one set my teeth on edge thing is in film and television when someone is trying to hold rope with their bare hands and it slides through their hands and it tears at their palms.
Oh, yeah, because that hurts so much.
Handle it. Ooh. And so, like, full points to Jack for wrapping his hands before he, like, touched the rope. But Locke did not do that, and it very much upset me when he was trying to belay her down. So, and he real fucked up. He fucked up there.
Yeah,
so,
Locke should know better. He's very resourceful and knowledgeable.
Yeah. He just goes too excited about getting down that hatch.
So, is it Jack eating shit on the Tortistan or Kate getting dropped down? Actually, she also kind of gets, like, yoinked. Like, it kind of seems like Desmond, if that's who did it, like, snatched
her. Oh, yeah, like, has
Desmond
a
and or the person using that other bed, I guess.
Yeah, it was a good old-fashioned hatch snatch. She got snatched on that hatch, and so that's my question. Is it Kate's hatch snatch, or I've decided that now sounds bad, or Jack falling down in the tortoise style?
Hatch snatch sounds better than snatch hatch.
Neil, Jack or Kate?
Well, since I've experienced the one that Jack did, and it hurt quite a bit, I'm going with the Jack one. That one, as someone who's had that fall, not fun.
Dave.
Neil's got a really good point. And I also kind of want to give Kate the, getting presumably kidnapped, if it's not falling down in your heart, you didn't really fall down award. Because she did her best, you know?
Oh.
It's not like she fell. Jack was just being a dick.
We also don't know how she landed. Someone could have caught her. She could have landed on a pillow.
Well, so you guys are both voting Jack, but I'm voting Kate because we haven't seen her. We don't know. We don't know what happened. Down.
So the mystery box of the fall is what makes it more intense for you.
But you guys say Jack, so you win. That's fine. But 2-1. 2 votes for Jack. One vote
let's
for
take it to Twitter.
It's going to make your gift Hatch more boring. Two Jacks already.
Jack eating shit is funnier than like a rope being jerked out of Locke's hands. It's true. All right. So that is one thing. And another thing, it's not really something we're going to vote on, but I just want to say that the Leslie Arntz Memorial Ironic Statement Award, I don't know how ironic it is. Is wrong ironic? I don't know. But it goes to Charlie, who goes, "Hey, Shannon, there are no others. Fuck off, Charlie."
I want to return to Kate down the hatch scene because I think it's a really good, not only is it a callback to the counting, which good job, Kate, reminding us of early on in season one in case we had forgotten. But I think it's just like a really good example of the kind of scene that Lost can add into a show that isn't necessarily giving me mythology and isn't giving me character. It's 100% pacing, but I love it. Like the door opening and closing and casting light on the mirror. We already knew all of those elements from the opening, and it's very studious, Jack Bender aided geography of the mirrors reflecting so you could see up the hatch. But not knowing if that man down there was, you know, like evil or benevolent, and it was obviously coming for Kate, is good television directing. Love it.
Yes, Jack Bender, very good at directing television.
We're going to hit on that a few more times on this Lost Rewatch podcast, I feel like.
One or two more times.
Did we have any special musical thoughts?
We have, I mean, obviously the song that starts the episode is Mama Cass's or Cass Elliot's Make Your Own Kind of Music. A great iconic Lost song. And a great, it's just a jam, just like a true jam. But Giacchino does have a little new piece of score in this episode. And it's called, Peace Through Superior Firepower, which is a jingoistic, foreign policy term that means like, it's basically peace through strength, right? Peace through superior firepower, means you could buy patches with this on it, and it's like a peace sign made out of guns, and you're like, fuck you, army. Yeah. But so I don't know. I'm curious what that's supposed to connote. Is it because this looks like some sort of militaristic fallout shelter type place? Is someone trying to accrue superior firepower in this episode? Like, you know, what are we trying to say here?
Is it the score that plays during the mirror sequence?
Yeah, it's right. It's like when the record stops and the score that plays there.
Oh, okay. So could it be the dynamite blowing up the possible safety of the hatch?
Maybe. I was Googling it earlier to try to find out the exact source of the phrase, and I couldn't find it, which is interesting. Usually you can find those kind of things on the internet.
Einstein said it, or Mark Twain. Those two people said everything.
I think it was Martin Luther King.
Oh, yeah. He said a lot too.
He definitely said peace through superior firepower. But, one bit of trivia I did pop up is that there is a, there's an iconic, like one of the t-shirts in Aliens, one of the characters in Aliens is wearing a peace through superior firepower t-shirt. So I didn't know if it was supposed to be some kind of Aliens reference. I don't know. I don't know what Giacchino was thinking. It's not exactly a straightforward boonerole. So I don't know what to tell you.
Throwing us even him in season two is getting more nebulous with his titles. How dare he?
Peace through superior firepower. I mean, usually when people like do something long like that, it's like I think it's just supposed to be like an army saying, I don't know enough about the army to like be like, oh yeah, of course, peace through superior firepower.
But Neil, Hurley tells yes. Jack about the numbers, and Jack is like, meh. How do we see, do we think that Hurley is going to become the voice of don't go down the hatch reason?
I mean, I think at this point, Hurley is appropriately freaked out, and Jack is under freaked out.
Jack does seem under freaked out for the whole middle part of this episode.
Yeah, it's like...
Until they take his girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like this... And I feel like this is
in
the show...
Shoes.
This is the show going into the extreme man of science, man of faith, because we are seeing Locke act in under extreme faith. And Jack, when presented with this story from Hurley, which... Who the hell would make that up, is all I'm saying. Like... You're on an island. Hurley just tried to jump on a bomb because of this information. And Jack's like, I don't think so, bud. You were in a psych ward. I don't believe it. Does not seem like he believes him at all, even though it's a pretty reasonably logical story based on the world in which they're living right now.
I'm much more annoyed at Jack, like, going, sure, Hurley, basically, than I was at Charlie. Doing it, even though I was still like,
well, that's
annoyed that Charlie
did it. Yeah. Charlie's kind of also, he's kind of a moron,
right? Yeah, like a Charlie's lovable just, moron.
He's yeah, I mean, he's done a lot of dumb stuff, so we don't have a lot of evidence that Charlie is like a capable, stable, good decision making person. Whereas the show really rams that home with Jack, where it's like, man, Jack. Miracles everywhere with this guy, even though he does not seem like a very good doctor.
Yeah, well, maybe... Oh, God.
Yeah. Well, is now the time that I get to talk about his wig?
Yes, please.
Yes, absolutely.
I know we've already... I think you both have already mentioned it. I have a reputation to maintain, which is that if there is a terrible wig on a TV show, I need to talk about it. We talked about Kate's terrible platinum wig during the Kate's Motel sequence. but this, I would argue, is even worse. Because I kind of know why it's there, but I kind of don't at the same time. It's a wig so bad. The main issue, I believe, are the bangs, which just sort of like go up and out in a like, almost like Midwestern, like spritz and curl bang situation. It's very bad. not even his surgical cap can contain it. Not even the bandana he wears while running can contain it, though. Like, I was really, I was audibly relieved when he appeared with that bandana. I was like, thank God they put something over that fucking wig. It's so bad. And I need to ask you guys why, like, who looked at that and was like, yeah, that's good. That'll work. That'll do. Neil.
Wait, like, who am I blaming for this?
No, I mean, it's a joke question.
No. I think you could trace...
Everyone?
You could trace the production, like, mishaps behind bad wigs. Because if it's a bad wig, it's not like, you know, makeup artists and people who choose wigs, they're talented people. So if it's a bad wig, something happened. So, like, maybe it was, like, rushed. I'm guessing at some point they're setting up these flashbacks. They have it written. They're going to do Sarah's backstory, and it's going to be like, great. They have like this shot. They're going to like pan to reveal like Sarah after the like, accident at the very end of that first flashback scene. And they're like looking at it, and they're like maybe blocking it with Matthew Fox. And they're like, this just looks like fucking Matthew Fox. Like, we just saw him and we've already seen Sarah. Are people going to like freak out after we just spent this opening sequence on a character we've never seen before? How do we know that we orient this to like the event that we see at their wedding? And they decided to double punch it, not only with her mumbling, I have to dance at my wedding, but fucking horrible wig.
Well, I mean, what's also true is that I think Matthew Fox is rocking like a particularly close buzz cut on Island. I don't know when Jack got that haircut, but he's got like, his hair is like kind of buzzed, in the season two.
Ooh,
opener.
Okay. So, theory number two, you can't get really good wigs, that are just like place on wigs onto nothing. Like, the best wigs are more like things that you could latch on to actual existing hair, you know, like Captain Jack Sparrow. Like, you have to grow out a little goatee to put on the braids. So maybe there just wasn't enough there, and so they had to go with a shitty wig.
I'm trying to think. I'm looking up Jack's, cause he has the short hair in the pilot. I'm trying to look up what his hair looked like in his wedding episode.
Ooh, yeah.
Do no harm. Like, what is... No, his hair looks totally fine. Like, why did... I mean, I just... Like,
but he was
understand.
So much younger, like, a year or two before his wedding when he met Sarah for the first time.
And everyone knows that when you're younger, your bangs grow up and out, and the hair at your neck sort of like sticks straight back out as well. And it's, oh, it's just,
maybe they were just like,
I love you so much, Lost. I'm so happy. I love this episode. I'm so happy Desmond is here, but I cannot, you know, I cannot give you a pass on that wig.
Here's my, I have a theory.
Yeah.
So my theory is that it was a perfectly good wig and it looked fine, but then they panicked because he had just been running and they were like, oh shit, he's probably really sweaty. So let's wet it real quick. And like wetting it made it look terrible or something.
So they tried to powder it and they were like, right. The powder and the water have formed a paste.
And they were like, why'd we shoot that scene first? Now we gotta match the shitty wig. And so there, right. Listeners, are the three options for excuses for the wig.
It's not the last time we'll see a bad wig on Law. I'd like to tell you that it ends here, but
bad
alas,
accents, bad wigs. The show's got it all.
It does not. All right. So that all happened and was great. Also, one thing that I love, and we can't really talk about it very much because we know too much, but I do love that they're like, okay, they're going to blow open the hatch. All right. There's going to be a dude inside. All right. It's going to be really like, oh, mystery upon mystery. We're doing so great. I want to know who in the room was like, what if we put the word quarantine on inside of the hatch door? Just to really fuck with them. So, anyway.
Yep. I just quarantine, the mural, the Jaxies, the shoes, I guess, is a weird mystery for not that long.
The magnet wall with the concrete. Right?
Yeah, I mean, this. I just love that. It occurred to me, having just listened to the interview with Damon Lindelof last week, how it's almost like they walked in to the toy store of sci-fi, and the network was like, fine, send the security guard home. And Lindelof was just like, all right, cool, grab everything now. Put it all in the hatch. Like, let's put a million mysteries in this hatch, because we're free, you know? Like, they know it's a sci-fi show now. Let's put weird mysteries in there. Let's do it.
Yes.
It's great. And it's great. So, and that's what I love about this episode.
And this episode also has, like, some hints to the structuring that, like, I was alluding to, where it's like we're suddenly down. The first time we go down the hatch, we go down with Jack. We go down with the man of science, so that what we see is, like, a little bit more objective and a little bit more what the fuck. Because, you know, you have somebody who's taking our place as our audience observer as we're first going through the hatch. But if you happen to, like, notice the sub, if you watch television with the subtitles on, which maybe isn't the best thing to do the first time you watch something, but definitely on rewatches is fun. There's hidden dialogue in the end scene under the music that hints that there's more going on down in the hatch, and those are all things that are like purpose mysteries within mysteries that will be answered like within an episode or two with more mysteries. And it's absolutely some of my favorite Lost stuff. I'm gonna say some like Drew Goddard, Brian K. Vaughan stuff, just because they joined in the Brain Trust season 2, but I don't know for sure yet. Maybe I'll spend some more time in season 2 researching that. Cool. Joanna, it seems like it, you know, we're in season 2 now. It definitely, season 2 didn't air in 2004. The people on the island, they're still in 2004, as far as they know, but they haven't really brought a lot of new things with them. Are we still going to do most 2004 thing of the episode?
I'm not sure, guys. I gotta say, we struggled a bit to find some most 2004 things about this episode, so we have something else planned. But in the meantime, before we get to that, I just want to ask you, our lovely listeners, if you have thought for a new running bit we should do in season 2 that's not the most 2004 thing, if there's something else that we should bring up, let us know. Like, basically, we're running out of Shannon outfits. We're not sure season 2 can sustain it. We're just going to get probably islandier from here on out. So if you have thoughts about the most something that we should do, let us know. In the meantime, we are going to do the most vintage thing about the hatch. So here we are. We are tied to a chair and a hatch of mystery.
We are stuck. We got dropped in a hatch in a jungle of mystery.
There's a man there. His name is Desmond Hatchman.
He's been hatch snatching.
Desmond McHatcherson.
You might have seen a flash of a logo that might look familiar if you're familiar with one of our logos. But here's my question. What is the most vintage thing about the hatch? Is it the Cass Elliott song "Make Your Own Kind of Music," which was released in 1968? Is it the Schwinn Exerciser bike, which was released in 1966? Is it the Apple II computer, which was released in 1977? Was it the Technics SLQ-3 record player, which was released in 1979? Or was it Desmond Hatchman's lava lamp, originally invented in 1963? So, the song, the bike, the computer, the record player, or the lava lamp. Dave, what's the most vintage thing about the hatch?
Although I'm tempted to say the lava lamp, I'm going to go with the record player for the ultra geeky reason that I bet it is belt drive, and that belt is wearing down from use, because magnetic drive turntables are the way to go.
Okay. Neil.
That was more information than we needed, but I appreciate it. I think I'm going to go with the bike, because I think watching this episode, the bike is the first thing that really looks sort of off in a way. Like, there's a lot of stuff as you get into the hatch that, you know, you start to realize that it, a lot of it is vintage, for lack of a better phrase. And I think that the bike is the first one where I'm like, wait, what time period are we in? Because it's all part of the opening thing. It's like, did something go terribly wrong here? Like, what is going on? So, I'm going with the bike. Really shocked me.
I'm going to go with, the computer.
the Frankenstein version of the Apple II. I will say, though, and I know folks, hopefully calm watchers notice this, but notice that there's one thing that's not vintage, at least so far that we've seen in the hatch, the camera kind of lingers on, which is the washer and dryer, which appear to be very early 2000s. So, which I think is interesting, you know, I mean, it is 2004, so.
It was from the future.
That was always a fun question for me, is like, I remember watching this episode and being like, where's that washer and dryer from? How'd they get that on the island? What's going on here?
Well,
and
then,
so
like,
those are some questions that I like exploring.
As far as we know, like, this hatch was the invention place of the washer and dryer, and those are actually, they're perfectly time period accurate.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, everything else is
from,
like,
we know.
For all we know,
the person who sleeps on that top bunk is, because he's a bottom bunker, right? Or is he a top bunker?
He's a top bunker, Desmond.
Okay, the person who sleeps on the bottom bunk is Cass Elliot herself.
Yeah.
For all we know,
or Martin Luther King Jr.
Right.
The person who sleeps on that bottom bunk is Don Schwinn, inventor of the Schwinn exerciser bike.
I'm just saying, if you watched that and you went, wait, what's going on with the washer and dryer? You're doing it right. Like, you are on the level.
I think my favorite detail of Desmond's morning routine, which we should say really quickly, there's a sequence in season 2 of Westworld that is incredibly similar to this. That Lisa Joy Nolan, who directed that episode, I think it's the Riddle of the Sphinx episode, nonetheless swears, was not influenced by this scene at all. And
has she never seen Lost?
She says she's never seen, she was in law school when Lost is on.
Someone should tell her that there's this really good podcast.
I interviewed her. Yeah. Oh, no. I mean, so I interviewed her when that Westworld thing came out. I was like, so this cool Lost illusion you have? And she's like, nope. And I was like, but? She's like, nope. And I was like, she's
you were like,
well,
let me have this, Lisa.
She said, well, she said something like my production designer might have seen it. Because it was like, originally she wanted a treadmill. Basically, if you haven't seen Westworld, it's not a spoiler to say we see a man in a like close confined room going through his routine. And it involves like putting a record on the record player and being on a stationary bike and, you know, doing a medical test on himself and, like, you know, all, like, it's very similar. And the exercise bike is really kind of the kicker. And she said that she originally had a treadmill in there, but that it looked too clunky, so she rolled the bike in there. But I was just like, Lisa, this is the craziest thing I've ever heard in my entire life, that this is not a Desmond illusion. I have a hard time with it. Anyway.
So the sled was named Rosebud?
Rosebud?
But no, I just came, it came to me in a dream.
My favorite thing about Desmond's morning routine is, yes, the fact that, like, he makes this smoothie for himself in the morning, which looks like some sort of, like, protein powder shake situation, and he puts maraschino cherries in there. So we can talk about what that means in the storm. I'm just saying it's one of my favorite details.
I, as a big fan of maraschino cherries, I also approve.
I don't think it's good. I'm saying if you're going to make a healthy, wholesome breakfast for yourself, you know, well, I guess I can't talk too much more about it. I'm just saying, like, never in a million years would I put a maraschino cherry in a smoothie. That's what I have to say. So, you know.
Wow. Really missing out, though.
I'm sure there's some preservative reason.
They're so sugary.
They're so bad.
He's in a hatch. He's down in a hatch. He's in a cherry.
He's in a hatch on an island.
I told you I'm going to talk about it in the storm. I have reasons. I just don't want to talk about them yet.
All right.
I mean, I'm not going to promise that he answered any maraschino cherry questions for me, but we do have Henry Ian Cusick, Desmond Hatchman himself, here to answer some questions. Should we hear from Desmond?
Let's do it, Henry, brother.
Henry Ian Cusick, take it away. One of my favorite things to ask people who do brilliant, consistent accents that are not their own on a show, and you don't sound like Desmond when you speak, where that accent comes from. Is this your dad's accent? What are you doing here on Lost?
Right. No one's ever asked me that question. That's really interesting. So I moved to Scotland when I was 15 from the West Indies. And obviously I didn't have a Scottish accent. But, you know, at 15, you're always trying to fit in. So I attempted the Scottish accent, and I was ridiculed often on the on the playground for having such a terrible Scottish accent. but I shot Lost when I was in my mid-30s, and my wife is from Isla, which is a little isla off the west coast. And, you know, I'd been living in Scotland for a long time, so I picked up the Scottish accent. I could do it, you know. And how did I get that voice? That's a good question. You know, because when I got the role, when I got the side to audition for it, I had no idea what to do with it. And I left it for about a week until my manager called me and said, "What are you doing with that? Are you actually going to..." I had to put it on tape. It was back in the days when you tape things, and
yeah,
a long time to get to where it was supposed to go. Anyway, and then one night there's a friend of mine called Kevin McCallum, and I just thought, I'll do it like Kevin McCallum. And that's what I did. So I sort of channeled Kevin McCallum. So there you go. So Kevin, if you're listening, it was all based on you.
One of my favorite bits of trivia that I picked up while sort of doing a little background on you is this idea that you had already met Carlton Cuse through Brian Cox, who was a friend of yours, before you sent in your audition. And that strikes me as a very Lost flashback sort of bit of coincidence. Is this a true story? What happened here?
Yeah, so I had gone out to LA to try my luck as an actor, and I was friendly. I had done a short film with Nicole Ansari Cox, who was married to Brian, and Brian in a short film called Stella Does Tricks, and Brian had done a very small role in it. Anyway, Brian Cox and Nicole, they're both very generous people, and any actors who are struggling, they would give a helping hand to. And so not only me, but many others. And they said, they had a big house, and they said, "Come and stay while you take some meetings and pilot season." And I remember Brian and I were doing something in the garage, and he said, "Oh, there's my neighbor, blah, blah, blah." I didn't really pay attention. "He's got a new car. Let's go check it out." And he came out. He's a showrunner for something. And all I heard was runner. I didn't think anything. I didn't really know the lingo, the jargon of showrunner was actually quite a, you know, that's a pretty big job. In the UK, a runner was somebody who's, you know, like a PA, you know.
Right, yeah.
I didn't think much about it, but it turned out to be Carlton Cuse. Cut to, there's me auditioning, and I had no idea Carlton Cuse was really involved when I did send in my audition. But yeah, that was a very, you know, coincidence. Are there such things? Who knows? You know, but that, you know, that was a kind of like a very Lostian, and we talked about it often, that, you know, how in, you know, art imitating life or whatever, but
yeah,
it was a very Lostian moment for sure.
So you famously had not watched Lost before you started, before you auditioned. What was your first impression of the sides that you got for your audition without the context of Lost to go with it?
Like most actors I was at a sort of entry level where you just get sides, you have no idea, you never get the full script, you never get the full. So I was always working on sides and just trying to figure out what was happening in the scene. And I had no idea. And I had just finished playing Jesus in the Gospel of John. So I was coming from a very sort of spiritual place. And I was thinking there's a lot of spirituality in this scene. And I channeled that. I thought I was an angel. And that's the way I did it. So I guess whatever's in your head at the time when you put in something on tape can affect, you know, your own interpretation is kind of can either work for you or against you. Sometimes, I mean, I've got it very wrong sometimes, but that one, I don't know. It just seemed to click. I don't know.
I love that. So the stadium run scene, is that what you did? And you infused it with sort of angelic spirituality?
Yeah, it was some other worldly thing when it says you've got to lift it up.
Yeah.
You've got to lift the what? Your ankle, you know, with the kind of a double meaning on what are we lifting up?
Yeah.
Our ankle or are we lifting up ourselves? You know, so there was, I felt I was giving him a message. I had no idea what the role was, to be honest.
Well, I mean, and so you then didn't understand the importance of you are what was in the hatch, which was this big mystery of season one of Lost. But when you were cast, is that something you had to keep a secret? Did you have to not tell anyone that, guess what, guys, I'm in the hatch. It's me.
No, well, I didn't actually know what they were talking about. They kept on saying, you're the guy in the hatch. And I would look at them and go, yeah, I read that part. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Uh-huh.
But the guys, the crew kept saying, you're the guy in the hatch. Yeah, I saw that in the script. But I didn't understand its significance until much later on, until I watched, because I was shooting it before I actually watched the show, and I thought, I'd better watch some of this stuff. And then I kind of got it. And even then, I didn't really get it. You know, I wasn't very bright all the way through it. I didn't really get the size of the show. You know, even when I was filming it, even when I was in episode, you know, season 3, 4, I didn't really understand the size of the show. It's only now that I'm, not now, but obviously it's only with hindsight that I really,
yeah,
you know, really when appreciate the legacy of the show.
When do you feel like that clicked into place for you?
I think when I went to New York, you know, I didn't really leave the island very much, but I went to New York and I saw the fan reaction. And I thought, okay, this is pretty big.
Yeah.
And then when we would travel, you know, to any as a group to any of these, TCAs or whatever, you know, and the fan reaction. But it was always on the mainland that I realized how big it was. In Hawaii, no one really bothered us much. In Hawaii, we just went to work, came home.
The opening of this episode is one of the more iconic Lost moments, this Desmond morning routine. Did you have music playing on the set while you were doing it, or is that something you did kind of dry?
No, it was all Jack Bender directed that episode. And I remember he said, right, sit down, tie your legs, do it faster. And then you get this thing and then you put the record on, you wash the dishes and I didn't really fully comprehend what was going on. It was only later on when I saw it, I was bowled over by it. I thought, there's no dialogue. It's all these quick edits. There's just fantastic music. But you get it, you know, you get exactly what's going on. You understand completely just with the camera movement and what's going on. It just, even now when I see it, I just think it's a great piece of television. I love it that it's just music and picture.
Yeah.
And you understand completely what's going on. It was really, really well edited, well shot, well thought out, you know, well written.
Well, Jack, you mentioned Jack. Jack's one of the most iconic, Lost directors. He directed your most famous episode. He's directed, you know, Game of Thrones, The Door. Like, he gets this emotion out of people in a way that I don't know I've seen any other director do. What do you think it is about, you know, Jack's particular genius? How does he get these performances?
I don't know. I always find him very easy to work with. I liked him and I find him easy to work with. And I would always watch, I hang out on set when I'm not shooting. Most actors would go back to the trailers, but I would always hang out on set and watch what he did. I just found him, here's what I liked about him. He would change. If the scene wasn't working, he would change it completely. I remember we did this scene, me and Terry O'Quinn, and it was when I'm down the hatch. It was, we rehearsed it in a certain way, and I said, Jack, this isn't working. And he completely changed the block. He said, right, okay, you're going to be down the hatch, and you're going to look up, and you're going to shout out, you know, I'll see you in another life, brother. But prior to that, it was all around a table. So not many directors would have done that. They would have stuck to their guns and said, this is how I'm blocking it, this is how I'm doing it. But he completely changed it. I always find directors, you know, he had an executive, he was an executive producing director, so he could make those calls and those and change things around and do what he wanted because he had so much. And that's what it's good. It's great having someone who's directing who has that freedom, because a lot of directors come in, they can't, they've got to stick to the script, you know, and the script is the blueprint, they've got to do exactly. But he doesn't have that. He can do as he likes if it's not working, you know, and he's intelligent and he's talented. And I used to love him. Watching him when he would say, right, this is what we're going to do. And he did the hand thing, you know, which the hand thing is the pretend camera. We're going to follow that. And then the camera is going to come around here and he'd do his hands and they come right and just close up in Ian's face. And we're going and that's it. And I think watching him do that would help me as well as an actor to think, okay, well, if he's, the camera's doing that, then I can just whisper this line. I remember doing it for, I think I crashed your plane. The camera comes right around me. And I remember the cameraman, Paul Edwards, who went on to direct, was saying, that's a big movement of nothing. And he said, no, it's going to work. It's going to work. And I don't know. He just inspired confidence. I always got, I always felt I did my best performances. I trusted him. I think that's what it is. I trusted him completely.
And you've got all these line reads that you have to do in this first season you're here where, you know, like, are you him or all this sort of stuff that's infused with so much meaning for Desmond, but we have no idea what it means, some of it. And maybe you as an actor didn't know. How do you infuse meaning in sort of mysterious things that maybe even the show writers don't know yet what they want it to mean in the long run, you know?
Yeah, I think it was the same for most actors. I think we were playing our truth,
right,
our realities, and just saying, well, this is what I think it means. And sometimes you would find that the writers, you know, saw what you were doing and, you know, you could influence in that way. Or you would get a very specific note saying, this line here is very important. You must say these words correctly. And that would happen often where they would say that you have to say these exact words. You drop a line or something. You just say, no, you have to say that because that's going to feature in 5 episodes from here or whatever. And, but by and large, you played it the way you thought. You infused it with whatever you thought was happening. And, I hope for the best. And that was, you know, I had done that before in a Pinter. Mm. In a theater. So it didn't come as a, like a what? I didn't need to know everything. I just played the scene and played my truth, and I'd done that before. So I knew that could work.
I know that you wound up moving your family to Hawaii, as a number of the actors in the show did. But I'm curious, I don't know if this is a silly question, but is there anything about growing up in the West Indies that made you particularly adept at filming island stuff that other people couldn't handle? You're like, oh, hours in the sun, I can do that, whatever. I'm an island person.
You know, yes, absolutely. Well, as soon as I arrived in Hawaii, I was reminded of my childhood in Trinidad. We were living at the time in the south of England, and my wife is also from an island on the west coast of Scotland. You know, not much sun, but still an island. So we were both very very used to island life. I was so happy that my boys could have the same sort of upbringing that I had on an island, which was, it is living in a bubble, but it's a great bubble. You know, growing up in Hawaii, I can only imagine just being idyllic. I grew up in Trinidad in the West Indies, and that was an idyllic, you know, childhood. So, yeah, it just fitted in perfectly for all of us. We loved it. And, you know, I still live there. That's still my base.
What was it like? I actually talked to Damon Lindelof about this recently. What it's like to show Lost to your kids. It's like for them to see the work that you did on that show.
So we all watched it together as a family when it came out live. Mm-hmm. And they were big fans of the show. I think they were the perfect ages. We arrived in Hawaii when they were 12, 8, and 6. So they loved the show. Also, I guess it gave them a certain kudos at school. You know, your dad's in Lost. You know, Matthew Fox, also his kids went to the school, the same school. You know, there was always the excitement of that from the kids. I'm guessing. I don't really know. But, we all watched it together, and they loved it. And what was it like showing it to them? They were always, what's going to happen next?
You know?
And I remember when the scripts would arrive at the door, they were always very excited to see what's going to happen. I wouldn't tell them anything, but my wife would read the scripts, so she was just, we were all, it was a very exciting time for all of us. You know, it was all very new, and you know, we're living in Hawaii from England and a big hit show. And, you know, just life was very, very exciting and very different. We weren't used to any of it.
What was the hardest secret for you to keep, over your course on Lost?
I never knew what was the secret and what was not. So in interviews, I became very good at talking about nothing. You know, it became like, I talk, but never ever say anything of any real interest, It was just like, talking about, nothing. People would say, that interview, you said nothing. It was just the most bland interview. So it just became a skill of like talking about nothing. I guess that's what politicians do, they just talk about nothing.
Yeah. And is there an actor on the show that it was particularly easy to work with that you just felt like you had a locked in chemistry with them?
You know, there's no one I didn't enjoy working with. But I will say Terry O'Quinn is probably one of the easiest actors I've ever worked with, in the sense that it's so easy just to engage, to talk as if you're having a chat. It's, you know, he has this thing about him. He has the sparkly eyes and the smile, but he just draws you in and makes you very relaxed. And it's very easy to work with somebody like that. He's really probably the one that I enjoy working with most, I think. Or the one that stands out as doing that. Because, you know, working with Matthew Fox, he was intense and he was always present. And I always thought Matthew was a terrific actor. Yeah. You know, you had Emerson. I loved working with Alan Dale. Sonia was always great to work with. You know, Dominic. You know, everyone was... I mean, I didn't work with everyone, actually. You know, so... But the ones that I worked with... but Terry probably stands out for me as being very... effortless. He made it effortless.
There are rumors that ABC might want to do a Lost reboot of some kind. If that were to happen, whether with anyone from the original cast or just a brand new start, you know, what do you think they would need to do to recapture that lightning in a bottle for another go at Lost?
What would they need to do? Gosh, if I could answer that, then, you know, then I should be running the show. That show, you're absolutely right. It captured lightning in a bottle, and people have been trying ever since. I remember after that show, everyone wanted to, it was always the new Lost, and everyone wanted to try and capture it again, redo it, you know, reshape it. It was going to be, we are going to be the new Lost. There were so many shows that tried to imitate, and no one could do it. And no one's been able to do it in that genre, I don't think, since Lost. That's why we're still talking about it. Right. Is there time for a new Lost? Yeah, I mean, hey, it would be great to go and revisit that, you know. It's not going to be an easy thing to do. It would have to be a completely different show, I think. Would it be about the island? Would it be about the characters away from the island? Would it be about new people coming to the island? Who knows? But why not give it a shot, you know? I mean, you can this give it a try. I mean, you can only get it wrong.
Excellent. Well, thank you again so much for your time. I really, really do appreciate it.
Pleasure. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It's always nice to revisit Lost. It's always nice to talk about it. So thank you. I appreciate the questions.
All right, now is the time on the show where we like to thank our Small Council Patreon subscribers. These are the folks that generously donate to our podcast. They get a bunch of extra bonus material. Like last week, they got the fun, full, spoilery, extended conversation with Joe Garfine and Damon Lindelof, our two lovely guests on the season 2 finale, and they will get a little extra Desmond, Henry Ian Cusick, some extra spoilery Desmond stuff as bonus this month, this week as well. So let me thank them, starting with Aaron Gawarik, Bryce Poles, Jeremiah Peck, Anja Susan Sadness, Diana Fisher, Sam Williams, Junta Slash Colt, actually, Delia Volch, Beth Weingarner, Mike Harris, Matthew Wilson, Joe Garfine, Grayson Owen, Rachel Simon, Guava Corvallis, Thomas Hatfield, Frank Perinello, Paula Silva, Chris Biscard, and Nate, all newcomers. Thank you all so much.
And I'd like to add some old hats to that pile of thanks. Lulu, Allison Heishman, Andrew Bird, Jen, Kelsey Lee Measure, Alex, Matt Polari, Sir Way, of course, Peter Hobson, Ann Luz, Lisa Romney, Hayden Carlin, Anna Bradbury, Felix DeSelby, Lawrence Medina, Serafina Cobain, David Snell, Jesse Baird, Nathan, and Justin Way.
Hey guys, guess what? I also have some people to thank. And even though I'm told these are people who have been with us a while, these names look new. That's how many people we have. It's great. Let's start with Aubrey and Jane Weibel, Amy GF, Lorenzo Ciandra, Ian Rowe, Dave L, Michelle Boucher, Amy Schreiner-Thomas, Shannon Como, Rachel, Scott McNeil, Laura Edwards, Monica Wolf, Chris, Aubrey Converse, Fainting Violet, Becca Heiser, Andrea Rodriguez Garcia, Lindsay Mitchell Ernesty, I think I got that one right, and Jonathan Hill. Thank you all so very much for being part of the small council at patreon.com/stormofspoilers.
And we're back for the storm. Joanna, you said we had some storm emails this week. I'm thinking maybe we do emails this week since, as I've alluded to, we're going to be back at this exact same cliffhanger next week. And then the week after that is orientation, which will have a storm where I get to talk about Dharma films.
We have the best guest for orientation. We have just two great guests. All our guests are great, but we just... good guests coming up, guys. So excited.
We found all these amazing guests inside of a hatch.
Yeah.
Yeah, we blew opened up a hatch and all these guests came tumbling out. The maraschino cherry, like, I know why he has a maraschino cherry. It's a maraschino cherry because he gets his food parachuted down. The cherries come in a can. Like, I get it. I get why it's maraschino cherries. I'm just saying, if you don't know that, he only gets his food from, like,
there's no
Dharma
more
cans.
Significant thing to the maraschino cherries other than it's obviously delivered to him.
No, I just didn't want to like talk about that because that's like I don't want to talk about the food parachute yet in the calm.
Yeah, that's true.
I just think it looks so to my California brain, it looks counterintuitive to see a maraschino cherry dropped in a health smoothie.
Well,
and then I'm like, oh, but of course it's the only cherry available to him because he gets his food dropped, and then I can't talk about it in the calm, but I wanted to bring up the cherry anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough for podcast purposes, but it's just another one of those things that the show is sort of giving us visually that are, like, the show is telling us all kinds of things about what's coming, including that there is a supply, a way for them to get resupplied at the hatch.
Right.
You know, I mean, you can't look at that washer and dryer and not think that there's some kind of supply system.
Yeah. All you guys with your hinting, all I was trying to say is they subtitled Kate in the fucking vents at the end of this episode, which I did not remember happening.
Oh, is she the one that says Jack?
Yeah.
Over the music. Because you see this, because I also watch it with subtitles. And you see the music, they're doing the lyrics for the music in the subtitles, and all of a sudden there's just one Jack. And I was listening for Locke because I was like, it's obviously Locke that calls out to him. But it's not, it's Kate. And we don't see that until next week or yeah.
Next week. Next week. Drift. Okay. Drift is next week. And then the week after that is, did I say orientation? It's orientation.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's all of them being in that. Those three. So Adrift goes back and covers the boat up to Jin and the others, and then loops back around and covers Locke and Kate, but still ends at this same cliffhanger. And then orientation finally resolves the hatch. Resolves, I say in quotes, because then we have to deal with the button and everything, and we get to, Hurley has to watch some food. So we're off the hatch. But this first trip down in the hatch is spread over like three episodes.
Okay, this email comes from Chris. It's incredibly long, but very good. So I'm going to do my best to edit on the fly as I read about it. Chris starts the email with some very nice stuff and says he just joined the small council. Thanks, Chris. Hi. He says, he was just basically like, I understand people want more storm content from you guys, and so maybe like answering these broader prompts might be a fun thing to do in the storm. So he's starting with this one, which is, what I thought of and would love to hear you three talk about more is the concept of the unreliable narrator as it applies to Lost, and in particular, the varied results this trope seems to have when received by a mainstream television audience, at least in the time when Lost was airing. Wikipedia has a pretty good definition of that states the obvious. An unreliable narrator is a narrator whose credibility has been seriously compromised. But it goes on to say that sometimes the narrator's unreliability is evident from the start, while sometimes we don't find that we've been misled until later. Lost, of course, doesn't have a narrator per se, but I think we can reasonably apply the concept to any character who spouts expository dialogue that seems ostensibly meant to further our understanding of the underlying mythology. At times, these characters might actually be misleading the other characters and by extension the audience. By that definition, I'd say Lost is a whole island of mystery full of unreliable narrators. The first example, in my opinion, is Rousseau. In your podcast episode about Exodus parts 1-3, Neil talked about how her appearance and exposition all on all sorts of topics drive the plot of those episodes, and yet she turns out to be wrong about a number of things. This includes things we learn by the end of part 3, as well as things we won't learn until later seasons. We might be forgiven for trusting her since she has previously provided new info to Saeed. And he appeared to confirm some of it is true, such as the whispers. In her defense, she seems more underinformed and deluded than deliberately misleading. Wikipedia has a list of categories of unreliable narrator, and Rousseau seems to fall into the combination of the madman and the knife. I've never known how to pronounce that word, N-A-I-F. I always say knife in my head, but like naive, maybe? A naive person, basically.
The knife, like the waif?
Yeah, but... I've never known how to pronounce that, and I'm too busy reading to stop to Google it now. In that she's both psychologically compromised and only privy to limited information. She fills in the gaps in her knowledge with her special brand of crazy, just like another knife we know and love, one John Locke. Locke's unreliability comes mainly from the fact that he is a true believer in the island and in his own destiny, and his faith leads him to take everything he encounters and fits it to the narrative. This doesn't always work out. He gets Boone killed in this way, for example. There are also a few times when he loses faith, and ironically, those are probably the times when he gets closest to the truth. I think there's fodder for discussion there. Then, of course, there is the fact that another unreliable narrator, the Man in Black, takes advantage of Locke's faith to manipulate him, which ultimately leads to Locke's death. But the Man in Black's crowning achievement in manipulation is obviously Ben Linus, who is in turn the granddaddy of all the unreliable narrators on Lost. Perhaps it's an artifact of the show's obsession with daddy issues, but on Lost, unreliable narrators beget unreliable narrators. Ben is manipulated, probably by Jacob via Richard, but definitely by the Man in Black in various guises, whether it be posing as Jacob or the ghosts of Ben Mother or as Alex Rousseau, et cetera, et cetera. Both Ben and the Man in Black are great examples of another category of unreliable narrator, the liar. They use misinformation or the selective revelation of partial/incomplete information to control others. On a show full of con artists, Ben is a pretty good one, but the Man in Black is running a longer con than even Ben realizes. And what is a con artist but a kind of unreliable narrator with nefarious goals? There is a lot more of this, believe it or not. So I'm going to leave it there while you guys start discussing, and I'm going to see if there's other parts that I have some thoughts about this.
No, I really like this because if you think about it, every main character, to a certain extent, has been in their own way at their own time, an unreliable narrator on Lost, because they are all working with, both the trauma of being through a plane crash and the lack of information. So the whole show is about having a lack of information. So it works. It works extremely well, and it's hard to know, especially with Locke. And this episode being called Man of Science, Man of Faith, it really sort of hits it on the nose, where we're starting to be able to question, like, Locke's faith is getting to the point where it's starting to become a question whether it's a good idea for anybody to be following him. But then, if just by itself that was the way that the story was working, that's fine. But this goes back actually to what Dave was talking about when they go into the hatch, and it's from Jack's perspective. The reason I think it's from Jack's perspective is because Jack is the one ultimately being tested in this moment. Like, Jack is about to have an event happen that's going to shake his science-iness. You know, like it's going to feel like some sort of divine intervention when he sees Desmond. And so Jack is the one being challenged the most in this moment. So I love that they focused on Jack. And I love that the flashbacks themselves are also sort of potentially unreliable narrators. You know, like the flashbacks sort of lead us down a path of like how we're supposed to be feeling about these characters at the time, but they don't always quite work the way, like exactly the way you think they're going to work out.
And I think that's where the double-edged sword is, when they're playing fun little jokes, like in the first Jack marriage episode where he's like fitting up his best man for a suit and you're supposed to think maybe that's, you know, the groom, like that right. sort of cleverness. When the show makes the viewer the only reliable narrator that is presented, that's what fosters crazy ass theories. And that's what season 2 of Lost was okay with. But by the time they got to season 6 and they realized that, no, we actually wanted answers to some of those questions, they realized that like a portion of the audience kind of missed the point, where it's like the show wants to be able to position the audience to be like in this episode's flashback, where we know the outcome. We know she's going to walk again. We know Jack's beating himself up for nothing because he has pulled off a miracle. So when it gets to the point where I'm only going to believe what I've seen on the show and my interpretation of that, that's super powerful because you played into the show's narrative hands, but it also gives the audience the power to be like, well, that means I expect answers to these things. And you can't be like, no, that was a lie, or no, that was like an unreliable narrative, because they're like, no, I saw it. And I lived with that question for long enough that surely you meant for me to be asking that question. So
yeah,
it's,
I mean,
these level of control.
These first few seasons of Lost really do feel like an exercise in submission, like submitting yourself to the fact that there's a lot of stuff that is weird and may not make a ton of sense. And I think that's actually part of what makes it an exhilarating show to watch, because it's like you're just going down this crazy rabbit hole and it just keeps getting more and more out there. I think that's part of what makes it great.
Yeah, so two things. Number one, the word is pronounced naive, like naive, but with a sound, so naive.
Okay.
Because there's like an umlaut over the I. It's a fun word. I've just knife. Never had.
It sounds like the Faubelia Baines woman saying knife.
Knife?
Knife?
Got a knife, honey, for your beans?
Got a knife for your Faubelia Baines.
Cut those beans out. 8 billion beans.
So thanks, Chris, for taking us on that journey. But also, Chris has a paragraph. It's a really long email. It's super good. And I really thank him. There's a lot of stuff I'm missing and I feel bad about that. But, Chris also writes, the unreliable narrator is a tried and true literary device. But when used in a show like Lost, which arrived in the sheep's clothing of a survivor-like mainstream network drama and whose mysteries inspired obsessive viewers to regard every bit of new information as a clue to the bigger puzzle, I wonder if unreliable narrators may have had a tendency to backfire, at least early on. Rousseau is a good example with her confident revelation that the smoke monster is a security system. Whether or not that turns out to be wrong later is arguable, but it's certainly not the truest answer. In any case, I clearly recall while watching in the first season that what is the monster was maybe the biggest question I had about the show. So to have a character like Rousseau, who though mentally unstable has lived on the island for so long, come out with such an important sounding nugget of info at the time felt like a gift directly from the writers to the audience. It was as if Darlton, which is the portmanteau of Damon and Carlton that was the fans came up with, were saying, we know you're obsessed with this, here's something to chew on. It didn't help that in podcasts and interviews they said things like, every time you see the monster you learn something new about it. This only confirmed that anything new we heard on the show could be taken as gospel from the powers that be. And so yes, then the misfire is when, you know, they sort of hand wave. Like I also, like I have a very relaxed attitude around like retconning and hand waving away things that they said early on and maybe later it's not true. Like I don't get agitated about it, but I understand why people might get like how this might set them up for people to get more agitated.
I mean, it's a power. Like since Lost, we've seen dozens of series that have wished people were watching close enough to, you know, pick
well,
up on
I,
those
I
things.
Mean, yeah, and if you want to talk about unreliable narratives and, like, mystery box shows, two very modern examples of that are Westworld and Mr. Robot, right? Where in both of those, you have a confused protagonist that they're trying to hide from you for a while what is actually going on in the head of the protagonist. And then the reveal is supposed to be this big, like, whoa moment. You know, it's the Fight Club reveal sort of thing. So, like, I don't know. It's a great email. We'll think more about it. What I really love thinking about is this idea of, it sort of leads me to thinking about this idea of con men on the island. Jo said this great thing when she was talking to us about, I just had to mentally double check we're in the storm. When she was talking about love pairs on the island, and she's like, okay, Juliet and Jack was Dr. Doctor, and Kate and Sawyer was Con. And those two things don't work, but you gotta mix them. You got Juliet and Sawyer, Dr. Con, Jack and Kate, Dr. Con sort of thing. And so, like, thinking
Dr.
about
Khan
the very...
Dr. Khan sounds like Captain Kirk's worst enemy.
Dr. Khan! So when you...
Or a really annoying YouTube channel about really bad conventions.
So when you think about the Man in Black as the ultimate con man, or Ben Linus as the ultimate con, like, thinking about all the cons and what that means, and what... Damon Lindelof, at least, is very interested in The Leftovers, and I would say in Watchmen as well, this idea of, like, the truth and weaponized lies, and when lies can be used for the, like, in both The Leftovers finale and I would say in the original Watchmen source material, this question of, like, a lie used for the greater good. Or does the truth even matter? That's the question. Does the truth even matter if the result, you know, if it's for the greater good? That's not a question we need to answer right now.
Well then.
But like in our like post fact, post truth, quote unquote, which is a phrase I really hate. But, you know, and that's how a lot of people view our society right now. I've heard that again and again in the recent years. Like, we live in a post-truth world. Truth itself doesn't matter anymore. That makes me feel, like, very scared and out of control. But it's something that I think Damon, with all of his fascination with, like, faith and science, is extremely interested in.
Well, and I also think that, you know, we've talked about this show being very interested in, like, testing faith. But I also think that this show is somewhat interested in the question of, like, how can you be conned through your faith? You know, like how much of faith is a con? So when we get to, and this is where the Man in Black stuff starts to come up with me, is like, when we get to the part where the Man in Black starts using Locke, it's like, well, he uses Locke's faith against him in that scenario. So I do think that the show is very interested in that. And I think that, you know, the email, it's a great email, and points out a lot of problems that the show could have depending on who you are, how you feel about it. But those are problems that the show does not have to deal with for a long time, which is something that's really interesting. So we'll watch as the show slowly deals with having to provide answers for a lot of its mysteries. And, like Joanna said, sometimes it works, sometimes it really doesn't, but, you know, it is a very lost thing for them to have, sort of mixed results explaining what's going on.
Yeah. I love the breakneck pace of it, especially at the beginning of season two. And like I've been alluding to, when we get to orientation, it goes like fucking bananas. It's like, you want to know what the hatch is? Great. Here's this video, and the video's like...
It's kind of like missing frames.
It's a straight exposition dump that has missing frames and that, like, answers all of your questions with another question that makes no sense.
Well, and that's what Chris also says in this great long email. It says something, he mentions Pierre, Dr. Pierre Chang.
Pierre Chang.
As an unreliable narrator, right? Because, like, sometimes he has a different name, and he often says conflicting things, and pieces of the story are missing, and, like, you know, so.
Well, and he's a super dangerous kind of unreliable narrator, because the Dharma thing, and I remember this specifically watching season two as it aired, as soon as you start to open the Dharma box, and all of this stuff comes flowing out, it is one of the like most fascinating parts of the show, which is just like, what the hell is going on with this company? And I just remember just obsessing over those videos, and watching, you know, I guess whatever the version of YouTube channels of the time was, it was probably YouTube channels. That's how long YouTube's been around. But it was like, I remember the breakdowns of people just going through these videos frame by frame. It was one of the first times I think I ever saw a show sort of poured over in that way. And yeah, it was probably one of the more fun ones of season two. Season two really is, it's just crazy info dump season. Like there's just so much information that they just roll out very casually at times.
Yeah. Peter Chang is another con man who begets a con man with his,
Miles
who could read people and takes their money. Anyway.
So true.
Oh, go ahead.
I know that we're running long, but I'm going to read one more email.
Okay. One more email.
Go for it.
This is from Jefferson Grubbs, who's also a small council member. I swear I'm not just reading, or at least a Patreon subscriber. I swear I'm not just reading Patreon emails, but the email is titled The Old Clickety Clack, a Security System. And so the email starts, talking about like how this idea of like the smoke monster as a security system, always seemed like a flaw, to him. But then he came up with this new idea, because the two people who have really described it as a security system are Rousseau and Juliet. And it's possible that their descriptions of Smokey as a security system is just a misunderstanding based on an assumption they made. They both know that the smoke monster has a habit of killing anyone who gets close to the temple, so they assume that it's protecting the temple. However, in season 6, we learn the temple houses a group of others led by Dogen. Is it Dogen? Dogen? I don't remember. Who are far more loyal to Jacob than Ben's tribe of Dharmaville living others. We come to realize that Ben's purpose as the leader of the others has been perverted by the Man in Black passing himself off as Jacob. However, the Man in Black can't exert the same influence over the temple's others since they're protected by the Man in Black. He can't enter the temple as long as Dogen is alive. In short, Jacob is the Man in Black's mortal enemy, and the temple houses a group of Jacob acolytes who cannot be manipulated by the Man in Black. Therefore, the temple and its incorruptible inhabitants pose a great threat to the Man in Black, being able to invade him and carry out Jacob's true purpose without his interference. Perhaps Smokey isn't killing people who get too close to the temple to protect the temple, but to prevent those people from getting inside and joining Dogen in a place beyond his reach where he cannot corrupt and manipulate them. Over the years, his action, killing anyone who tries to get in the temple, has been misconstrued by those who don't know the Man in Black's true purpose as being protective of the temple, while in reality, he's simply been murdering people before they have a chance to slip through the temple's defenses and evade his grasp. I have two questions about this. Number one, I think one of the security system misconceptions comes from, like, maybe Juliet's misconception of it being a security system comes from the fact that, like, Ben can call the smoke monster in a very extreme circumstance. He calls the smoke monster, which I think is just the Man in Black, like,
pretending.
Further duping, duping Ben into thinking that, like, he works for him in any way. But the temple thing, I don't know, because like, I gotta think about Cindy when I think about the temple. And I know Cindy goes like in and out of the temple. Cindy, the flight attendant. So it's not just like a core group of like temple loyalists who have been there and nowhere else on the island. Do you know what I mean? Like people go in and out of the temple.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, if I can completely agree with that, but. It's something to think about. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, it goes to actually what we were just talking about with the sort of unreliable information. It's not necessarily unreliable narrator. It's just like we're not working with a full deck of information here. And neither are any of these characters that we've met. And I think essentially one of the more impressive things about Lost is that it gets very far into the show without giving us or a lot of its main characters all of the information that they need for sort of the end. And so the rollout of that information is slow. So I think, you know, the smoke monster is just one of those things that for the people who have seen it that are on the island, you know, Rousseau, Juliet, or they've had interactions with it. It's one of those things that's so big for the human mind to understand what the hell is going on there that like security system is a really easy way to sort of understand what that might be if you saw it and no one explained it to you. You know, like you have to assume that they either saw it or heard from someone that saw it, and they didn't get all the information, so they're just assuming security system, which I think is a totally fair assumption.
I could believe that Danielle assumes it because it was defending the temple. Like, that tracks for me. Like, the thing that reads true about the email is the idea that the man in black would want some more control over these non-controllable Jacob acolytes. But I think Joanna's right about the Juliet side of it in terms of what she describes it. And that mm-hmm. makes Neil right about the unreliable narrator thing.
Yeah, because Juliet's
you
just
get to
working.
Be right, and you get to be right.
That's the thing we learn very quickly about Ben, is that Ben is the ultimate unreliable storyteller in this world. You know, I mean, he starts with all the big lies, and then and the more we know about Ben, the more we realize that he's just lying to everyone. So it's pretty wild. He's coming soon. Season
Ben,
is that two or three?
Ben. Yes, sir. No, two.
Two? He's in two?
Henry Gale, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Oh.
Well, except we have to call him Henry Gale for a really long time.
Yes, so that's a, that should be a Storm segment where we talk about the things that we can't say in the calm yet, because I think
Hume
is one of them.
Yeah, Swan Station.
Swan Station. Somebody wrote in the notes. We can't call it the Swan Station yet.
Waltz in the computer. Electromagnetism.
We could say electromagnetism. Oh, no, we can't say electromagnetism.
The numbers,
yet.
The doomsday clock.
Well, the numbers are good.
Yeah. Yes,
Ben Linus. The name Ben Linus shows up very, very deep into Henry Gill's life on screen.
We're gonna have to
talk amongst ourselves what we're gonna call him. I think we just should call him like the man or old bug eyes or something like that. Like, I don't think we should commit to which name we call him, because if we call him Henry Gale, are we confirming that he said? Anyway, we'll talk about this off air. A lot of things to navigate. We will talk about the meeting before you guys stop drafting me an email about the philosopher David Hume. We'll get to it when the commies know that Desmond's last name is Hume. I'm not doing two Hume segments. That'll tell you right now. But something we do know about
also,
Desmond.
Also, we got tons of Desmond time. He's on the show till the end.
It's true, but something you know that's true about Desmond is that he was only supposed to be on for like three episodes. They just liked Henry Ian Cusick, or he goes by Ian. They liked Ian a lot, and they kept him. And so then they had to give him a last name, I guess. They're like, oh, I got to keep this guy around. I guess he gets the last name. No,
they were like, philosophers named Desmond.
Yep. We'll do that. Next week, we'll start, or the week after next week, we'll start getting into the dharmas. We got a lot of good storms coming up. And then, even though Joanna said, like, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes ago, that she's very willing to let some of this early stuff hand wave away, waltz in the computer, and you'll see her break this season on the storm. Guys, until we reconvene down in the hatch, but from another perspective, where can people find your work online? Let's start with Neil Miller.
Well, you know, you can always get me over at filmschoolrejects.com. You can also follow Twitter at One Perfect Shot, which this week, if you're listening to it in real time, just passed 500,000 Twitter followers.
Ooh.
That's so crazy. Yeah, so there's that, and then follow our show at Storm Podcast, and send us emails, host@stormpodcast.com. Can't wait to see everybody in Denver. It's gonna be great.
And Miss Joanna Robinson.
You can find me at vanityfair.com talking about the end of Succession, the beginning of Watchmen. This week on Podcasts Elsewhere, you can hear me talk to the great Laura Dern, who I got to sit in a room with for an hour last weekend.
Dern.
Hatch.
Was she okay? I only have one question from this, and obviously I'm going to consume all the content you create from it, but was she more Space Dern or more Dino Dern in the time you spent with her?
She had boots on, but they were like high heel boots, so like,
okay,
both.
Oh,
I don't know.
So like Dino Dern who went to space.
Yeah, Dino Dern in space.
Got it.
And then if you want to hear me talking to another person, if you're not tired of my voice, you can hear me talk to Tim Blake Nelson on the Still Watching podcast about Watchmen and some other things. So that's fun. And that's all I have to say about that.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast. We just recently did our quarter quell for our favorite slash best movie of the past 10 years. We debate what that means. Check it out if you want, wherever fine podcasts are distributed. And it is very important now that there's an open hole in the ground leading into a hatch of...
Wait! I'm so sorry. I forgot to give my Twitter handle, which is obviously at Walt is not on the computer. Okay, please go ahead.
It's very important now there's a hatch of mystery in the ground out in the dark jungle that you don't fall down.
Been with you right where you.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.